we shall reach the core of the subject of this lecture, which is renormalization theory. So, what I shall be trying to do today is to explain to you on the simple case of interacting quantum field theory, and by just a first order calculation in the coupling constant in H bar, therefore, so a semi-classical quantum calculation. What is the idea behind renormalization in quantum field theory? Why is renormalization needed? What is it, and what are the consequences of renormalization for the property of a quantum field theory? So we have seen last time that first, when you are doing perturbation theory, perturbative expansion in a quantum field theory, we have a problem because we have short distance ultraviolet divergences. Okay. We have seen also that those ultraviolet divergences comes from, in fact, they come from the fact that the propagator of the free theory has some particular short distance behavior or high energy, and it comes from the fact that, in fact, in the free theory, correlation function of products of operators, so products of local operators, are singular at coinciding bonds. And that's a feature of any quantum field theory, so it's not a problem with the quantum theory of fields. It's just a feature of quantum field theory. Products of operators which are at a different point are perfectly well defined, and they allow to define all what we need to know about free field. But when you start to have two local operators and you look at how they behave at short distance, there is something which blows up, because the quantum field is a very singular object. It does not behave at all as a classical field. Okay? And we have seen that, in fact, singularities are governed by something which is the operator product expansion, because it means basically that, in fact, the singularities in products of operators are not something which is completely wild, but it's governed also by local operators. So we have seen that, for instance, that the product of a phi operator at point x and the phi operator at point 0, let us say, is in fact behaves like there is some coefficient, which is in fact x minus y to the power minus 2 in 4 dimensions. There is some number, and that's a coefficient, and then the operator 1 at 1, and then you have something which is regular, which is, in fact, another operator, which is the operator phi squared, but defined by a normal product operation at the point 0, and then you have higher order terms. So, in fact, so those are coefficients. This contains the divergence, and those are operators. Therefore, you know, if you insert that in you want to compute matrix element of products of operators containing these products of two operators, you know, you have to compute, matrix element of those operators which are well-defined objects, and the singularities are contained, for instance, here in this one. Okay? So now, if you add on the tutorial of yesterday, you should now understand that when you are considering the products of two normal ordered phi 4 operators, it has an operator product expansion, which contains an operator which is of the form 1. It contains the operator 1. It contains the operator phi squared of 0. Well, it contains plus subdominant terms that I will not describe here. And here it contains the operator phi 4 itself. And then it contains some other things. And in fact, here you have a factor. Of course, it's x. It's not x minus y. Because here there is a coefficient x, which is just x to the power minus, I think, 8. Here there is a power which is x minus 6. And here the coefficient is an x to the power minus 4. And this comes, in fact, just from what is called the dimension of those operators. And then you have some coefficient here. So I have not written what are the coefficients here, but here you have, some coefficient, let us say C1. Here you have some numerical coefficient C2. Here you have some numerical coefficient 3, etc. Okay? And you see in particular, and in fact, well, in addition, those coefficients are given by products of propagators. This divergent term is given by products of propagators. So, in fact, for instance, this is in fact is given by a product of 4 propagators between x and 0. And each propagator comes out with an h-bar factor. So this is a term of order h-bar to the power 4. This is a term which is given by a sum of propagators like that. So it's a term of of order h bar to the power 3. And this seems a term which is given by a product of 2 propagators between x and 0. And therefore, it's a term of order h bar squared. Okay? So you see that, in fact, this is much lower. This is a term which is of which should appear sooner in perturbation theory than those terms. Okay? Yes?
So if we go further in the perturbation series, the powers of h bar become smaller here. Will we get inverses of h bar?
When you invert, you?
If you continue the series.
Yes, then you will have something which will be of order
so h. Those contributions will be very
and then something which will be 1, of order 1. Yes.
And does it continue?
No, you cannot have negative. Power of h bar. So for instance, here you had just an h bar, and here you see here you had an h bar, and here you had a factor which is over the 1. And in fact, the other terms are operators involving derivative of phi, but they are always over the 1 in h bar. So you cannot have negative powers of h bar in the perturbative expansion because we have seen that the perturbative expansion is an expansion in fact in power of h bar.
We've also seen that h-bar kind of counts the number of loops.
Because h-bar counts the number of loops. And here you have, three loops, but in fact you have an additional h-bar in front of that, if you count things right. So you have here 3 loops, here you have 2 loops, here you have 1 loop, etc. Okay? So in fact it means loops. No, that's okay. Okay. So, what I want, if I remind this, that's because, in fact, the ultraviolet divergence comes from those coefficients, from those terms. For instance, this is the Dangerous term, this is the Dangerous term, and this will be, in fact, the Dangerous terms which appear in what I will be discussing today. And, in fact, so it means that you have singularities when you are doing a perturbative expansion, and to do a perturbative expansion means computing expectation values of objects which are integral over the position of points of products of fields, of operators involving the field operator. So those integrals are divergent, but the divergence is contained into a term that's an operator which is local. So the divergence, in fact, what the operator product expansion tells you is that those ultraviolet divergences are
they are proportional to local localization. Okay? So perturbative expansion means adding perturbative expansion means add phi 4 operator to the either action or the Hamiltonian of the theory, if you want, depends which quantum you prefer. So you see that when you had an operator in the Hamiltonian of the theory, you run into problems. But those problems are proportional to the insert local operator. They are proportional to operators you have inserted in the theory. And this suggests, and that's the basic idea in perturbation, that the problem contains its own cure. Because you have a problem because you have added a local operator in the theory. You get ultraviolet divergences proportional to local operator, which means that perhaps the only problem is that you have not added those operators, you have not changed the theory to go from a free theory to an interacting theory. You have not done the things properly. But if you do things properly, adding a local operator to the theory in a well-defined way, you will get a finite interacting quantum theory. Okay. So that's the basic idea, which is in beyond the renormalization program. Okay, so now let's go back to the explicit equation. We shall consider the phi 4 theory. And for simplicity, I will consider only the phi 4 theory in the case where it is massless. Okay, because that's a simple case and already contains all the physics we need for what I need today. So what is a massless field theory? The massless field theory means simply that I take as an action S of I. Let us keep the Euclidean formalism. So this is Euclidean formalism. Otherwise, you just change the sign of the metric. So if the theory is massless, it means simply that I set the mass to zero in the classical theory. This is called the classical. So I have only two terms in the action. Okay? And this theory has an important property. This theory is not only invariant and Poincaré or Euclidean, if you are in conformations. Means that if you have a solution, a classical solution deriving from this action, if you make a translation in space-time and a rotation or Lorentz boost in space-time, you get another solution of the equation. The equation of motion are invariant under Poincaré transformation or under Euclidean transformation if you are in Euclidean space-time. But there is another invariance associated to the fact that the theory is massless, which is scale invariance. And scale invariance means that if I change the field, the position in space by a factor lambda bits, and if I change the field, so let us call it x prime, okay? And if I change the field phi by the same factor lambda, let us call this phi prime. Okay, so this means that I define, in fact, the transformation acting on the field which to field phi, the configuration phi bits, associate the phi lambda of x defined as lambda phi lambda x. Okay. So to any configuration of the field, let us draw one configuration in terms of 1x, let us say it's x0, and this is phi, you see. So this is the configuration of phi,
And if I change phi by a factor lambda, and lambda is positive, in fact, this means that I am considering a function, let us say lambda negative, I am considering something smaller, I am considering doing something like that. So here is a phi, see? Here is phi of lambda for simply lambda less than 1. Okay? And you see, you make a dilation of space and a scale transformation of phi in the field. And you can check very easily by you change the variables that under this transformation, the action of the original field configuration is equal to the action of the field configuration where you have made a scale transformation. So this is a scale transformation. It's a transformation which acts both on space and time, and the field, and, but the action stays unchanged. So it means that you have an additional symmetry to the theory. And for instance, and that's the, under this transformation, you see, G doesn't change. So you have this transformation for any value of the complete constant. So it's a symmetry, so it's a new symmetry of the theory. So there is a current associated to this symmetry. This current is conserved. And well, it's a good exercise, and perhaps you have studied that already with Kostia Zarembo to write what is this curve. I won't need it, but perhaps you have. Okay. So now the question is, what do we do now? So that's for the classical theory, and now let us consider the quantum theory. Quantum matchless. Okay. We have seen that, in fact, we have seen that this theory has a massive theory as we traversed divergent systems. And therefore, as an intermediate step, we shall introduce what is called high energy. Cut-off or equivalent, which is that's equivalent to what is called the short distance regulator. We shall assume that in fact our quantum theory makes sense up to a minimal distance A. So that, in fact, all the distances I consider are much greater than this minimal distance A. Or, if you want, there is a maximal, yeah, a maximal energy or momentum, that's the same thing, we are in relativity, that I will call lambda, which means that all the momenta I have in my theory are smaller than this maximal momentum that I call capital lambda. And the relation between the minimal distance and the maximal momentum is simply that lambda is pi divided by A. See? Yes? Okay. So, of course, you have to be, if you want to do really, really precise calculation, you have to do it to precise exactly how do you introduce this minimal distance or how
do you introduce this maximal energy when you formulate your quantum theory. Okay? And in fact, for instance, one way to do that is an example. Start from the space-time in Euclidean space, which is R4, and change it into a lattice, a four-dimensional lattice, so you discretize both time and space, with a minimal length A. And you define your quantum theory on, so this is time, Euclidean, if you want, this is space, and this is space. And what you are doing is that, in fact, you are discretizing space, and you are discretizing time exactly as you did when one started to define what is a functional integral or a path integral. So that's one example. There are others. Example to define a theory with a cutoff. Okay? Of course, when you do that, you run into problems, of course. If you do that, you run into problems with some of the basic principle of a quantum theory, for instance. If you introduce a lattice, you have problems with Lorentz invariance. Okay? Or, by user way, you have problems with unitarity, because your quantum theory is not no more really defined on an Hilbert space with a positive scalar product, or problems with causality. You may very well, if you make a change of the theory by introducing a minimal distance, have interactions which propagates at a speed which is faster than the speed of light. So your theory is no more a theory with a well-defined causal behavior. Okay. But those problems are expected to occur only at very high energy or at very small distance. You see? Okay? So, once I have been doing that, and I won't be more precise because I will not need exactly to know how I have modified my theory in the rest of my calculation. I will proceed with the calculation. Yes?
So why would it take like really high energy to run into problems? Like if I have an observer who is holding a stick that is as short as it can be.
Yes.
What about like another observer? Would he also think that it's as short as it can be if they're moving relative to one another?
I think that if they are far away, that's fine. The problem is that if they become close together, you see, if the two observers at a distance which is smaller than A, or if they are separated by a thick time, it's the same observer which is making two observations at a time interval which is smaller than A, then you run into problems. You start to see some strange thing some strange things happening. So, yes?
So, is this related to the fact that there is no Lorentz invariance anymore? Because
if you run it into a lattice, of course, it will be related to Lorentz invariance. For other problems, for other ways to introducing those cutoffs, you can preserve Lorentz invariance, but then you will run into problems with unitarity or with causality. I want just to send you the message where when you are introducing a regulator or a cutoff, you always some problem will occur in the theory. Those problems will occur at high energy or at small distances, and one has to check that this can be done in a consistent way, and then one can remove this cutoff and recover a safe, a clean quantum field theory. Okay. Because of course the idea is to introduce a cutoff, do the calculation, and then try to remove the cutoff, making sense of the result. You see? Okay. So first I introduce a cutoff, That's an intermediary step in my calculation. It's just a way to control the ultraviolet divergences. And then I will compute at order h bar, so at first order in perturbation theory, some quantities, some observable of the theory. Okay, so the question is that if I want to compute some observable of the theory, I have to start from an action. And I will take an action for the field, action in the, for instance, in the functional integral for the field, I will take an action which will not be exactly the bare action, but the general form of the action for the theory. So I take an action which I call SR. R stands for renormalized of my field variable. And I take an action which is of the form d4x, and simply I allow all the terms I had in the theory plus phi 4. Okay, but simply I don't know very well exactly what I have to put in my action. So at the moment I do not choose exactly what are those coefficients in the action, so I'll just call them A, B, and C. Okay? And I simply assume that in the limit h bar goes to 0, I want to recover the classical theory which is massless, therefore A will be 1 plus something over the h bar. B will be 0 plus something of order h bar, and C will be some complete constant that I will call the renormalized complete constant plus C1 something of order h bar plus some correction of order h bar squared. Okay? So it means that I choose an action so that when h bar equals 0, it corresponds to the classical action, which is massless. And otherwise, I don't know very well what I have to put in my functional integral in order to compute correlation function. And all what I want is that the green functions correlated with that, so is that the observable of the theory, are finite and are those of a massless theory. So I'm asking which action should I put in the functional integral in order to recover a quantum theory which is a massless quantum theory. See? Okay. And so, for this, we have seen when we have discussed the structure of perturbation theory that, for instance, if you know what is the effective action of the theory, the quantum theory, you can recover all the observable of the theory, all the correlation function of the theory, and from that you can compute. So in fact, it's enough to consider, you can consider other quantities, but it is enough to consider the effective action of this quantity, okay, of this theory. And we have seen that the effective action of this theory can be expanded. So this is gamma of phi, where phi corresponds to the expectation value of phi in this theory. And I am computing the effective action of this theory with this renormalized action in the functional integral. So I will denote it by effective action, renormalized effective action. It means simply that the effective action is computed with this action in the functional integral. You see? And now I apply, what is it? So you know that the effective action is given by the sum over the irreducible diagram. So for instance, I can compute first the term of order phi squared in the effective action. And we have seen that the term of order phi squared gives you the 2 points irreducible diagrams, sum, okay. And therefore, in fact, this term is of the form, the term of order phi squared is the effective action is of the form 1/2 integral over dz1, dz2, phi of z1, phi of z2, times a term which is a function of gamma 2 of z1, z2, okay? And this gamma 2 of z1, z2 is given, we have seen that gamma 2 of z1, z2 is given by this truncated propagator. That's just the integral kernel of the kinetic part of this. And then we have a plus a factor which describes this diagram, 1, 2, plus, etc. Yes?
Listen, but we didn't really introduce the notation gamma bracket 2, which is the... did you mean the second...
This is just the second derivative with respect to the right. Field of this gamma 2. Right. Corresponds to the second derivative with respect to phi at point z1 delta of delta phi at point z2 of gamma. Okay. Okay, so it's given by this sum of the diagram. And simply now you have to consider that the propagator here is a propagator for this free theory. And this is a diagram associated to this coupling constant. And so that's a term of order h bar. That's a term of order 1. And it's better to consider to go in Fourier transform. Because that's an amplitude associated to a diagram. That's an amplitude associated to a diagram. So I consider the Fourier transform of this object, which is now a function of two momenta, P1 and P2. Okay? And in fact, by translational invariance, there is a factor 2 pi to the power 4 delta 4 of P1 plus P2. And then there is a function that I will call gamma, let us say, bar of 2 of P1, which is just a function of P1. Okay? And I have to consider what is this function, gamma bar of P. Okay? So for the ordinary, for the phi 4 theory, for the free theory, it will be simply P squared plus M squared. Okay. But here now, remember that I have an A, so in fact here it's A times P plus B. Okay? That's the contribution of this term. Then you get the contribution of the second term, and the contribution of the second term is (coughs) Or is there a plus or a minus? No, it's a plus. Then there is, so the complete constant now is replaced by C. So there is a factor h bar, there is a factor 1/2 which comes from the combinatorics, there is a factor C, that's the complete constant of theory, and then there is this integral, and I will denote this integral by a factor, by an integral T. So T is just with T equals integral over d4k divided by 4 pi by 2 pi to the power 4 of the propagator, which is 1 over a k squared plus b. That's it. It's just a contribution of this loop diagram. Equal contribution of this diagram. See? Okay? But now, remember that we have chosen that A is 1 plus something, B is 1 plus something of order h bar, C is something plus something of order h bar, so I can re-expand the two-point function, gamma bar of 2, as, what's the gamma of, there is a 2, but let me put it here, because I am, it's a two-point function. So I can expand that in order of h bar, and remember that this is p squared, plus 0, plus something of order h bar, and what is this something of order h bar? It is p squared, well, a1 times p squared, plus b1, plus C is GR plus something of order H bar, but this is already something of order H bar, so I can replace it by GR. And in this integral, I can replace E and B by their value for H bar equals 0, so I can replace this by integral D4K over 2 pi to the power 4 times 1 over k squared, okay, and then plus things of order h bar squared, which I will neglect. You see? Okay? So that's the general formula form for the Fourier transform of the two-point function, of the two-point irreducible function, if I choose this action in the functional integral to compute the effective action and the correlation function, the Green function, and the vacuum expectation value of products of operator in my theory. Okay? See? So, now, of course, you see that there is an ultraviolet divergence here. There is a problem. There is an ultraviolet divergence. Okay, in this theory. And, but if I have introduced this cutoff, I can basically replace this integral by something which is assuming simply that this integral, you see, is there is a factor 1/2, I am sorry, that I forgot. Then you can, this integral, in fact, this big integral, which is infinite because at large momentum it's divergent, if I have introduced my regulator, I can replace it by the integral of d4k divided by 2p to the power 4 1 over k squared for momenta which are smaller than this energy cutoff, you see. And then this integral becomes finite. It's just diverging like lambda squared if lambda is large. You see? And if you do the calculation, pop, 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 at the end, you realize that there is a factor 1 over 4 pi squared. Okay, that's a normalization. It's not very important, but there is a normalization. Okay? Okay. So, now, well, keep that in track. That's very important. I want the theory to be a theory which is massless. You see? The fact that the theory is massless means that the two-point function gamma 2 bar of p has to be equal to 0 when p squared equal to 0. Because if it was not 0, if it was 0 for a p squared different from 0, it would mean that the theory would have a mass. That's the only condition, that's the condition which is necessary for the theory to have a spectrum which is made out of massless boson, particle with mass equals 0. Okay? And I think you have seen that in the lecture by Kostia Zarembo, because you can show, for instance, that the correlation, the Fourier transform of the full propagator of the interacting theory, okay, of this object is a function which is called the Green function, the two-point Green function. It's a function of a momentum p, and in fact, you have seen also in the in some tutorial that this is just the inverse of the function I am interested here. Therefore, if you want that the Fourier transform of the two-point correlation to have a pole or at least a singularity at p equals 0, this implies that this function gamma bar of p must be 0 at p squared equals 0. Yes?
In the first theory, we found that this g at p was 1 over p squared minus m squared, or p squared plus m squared in the Euclidean.
Yes, but so in my notation, in my with my choice of signature, which is minus plus 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 Minkowski, remember p squared is p zero is minus p zero squared plus p squared, so it's minus the energy squared plus the momentum squared. And therefore, this must have a pole at p squared plus m squared equals 0. So, it has a pole when the energy E squared is equal to p squared plus, so the mass condition is E equal square root of m squared plus p squared. Yes?
Sorry. But here we are in Euclidean space-time, right? So
here,
so that can only be satisfied when p is basically zero.
Here I'm not. No, in fact, here I did the calculation in Euclidean space, but now I have a function which depends only on the square of the momentum here, and that's just a pure number. So that's a result which is valid both in Euclidean space. Oh, then you take p squared to be equal to p0 squared plus p squared, but this result is also valid in Minkowski space. Remember, the advantage of Euclidean space is that you can do easily calculation in Euclidean space, and once you have a result, you change back the position of the momenta to the Minkowski space. And that's what I am doing. So this result is valid both for Euclidean And Minkowski. See?
So this P is not necessarily.
So zero. This P here, what I call phi squared, is given by this in Minkowski. This is P zero squared plus P squared in the Euclidean. And it is minus P zero squared plus P squared in Minkowski. Okay? But in any case, if the mass is equal to zero, the pole of G squared is at P squared equals zero. Therefore, gamma squared has to be equal to zero at P squared equals zero. Whenever P squared is the modulus of an Euclidean function vector or a Minkowskian vector. Okay? Okay. So, you see that I want that gamma squared, that this function to be zero at P squared equals zero, and namely to be the propagator of a massless particle. And you see that in order to do that, you can choose A1 to be equal to zero, because here that's just a multiplication, it's just a rescaling some finite renormalization of the field operator, so I can easily choose A1 equal to zero. So A is equal to 1, that's easy, but B1 has to be equal to minus 1 half, so this is 1 over, if you want, 1 over 32 pi squared pr lambda squared. And therefore it is different from 0 and going to infinity, minus infinity if you want, when we try to get rid of the ultraviolet regulator. You see? So, it's important that in order to have a theory which is massless, namely the full two-point function as a pole at P squared equals zero, we should start from a functional integral with an action in the functional integral where there is a mass term which is non-zero, and not only it's non-zero but it's negative, but it's proportional to GR. You see? So you need to start from an action in the functional integral with a mass term proportional to h bar, remember, and to the Kuprick constant in order to get a theory which is massless. You see? A theory which is physically massless. When you look at the observable of the theory, they are finite, the two-point function is finite, and it has a pole at P squared equals zero. Therefore, its spectrum contains massless particles. Massless, spinless particles. Okay? You see? Okay. So, this effect is called mass normalization. Because it means that if you start from a theory which has no mass, if B equals zero, then, so if this term is equal to zero, then you end up with a theory which has mass, a mass which is positive, but which is the order of the square of the ultraviolet cutoff. So if you start to define your quantum theory by starting by your functional integral with no mass, you end up with a theory which is a mass which is very, very, very large, and of the order of the ultraviolet cutoff, of the cutoff in energy you have. So in order to have to obtain a physical theory which is massless, you need to cancel this effect of renormalization of mass by the quantum fluctuation by another mass term, which is minus this one. So this effect, you need a mass renormalization, and the fact that you B must be something like that, the fact that you must start from a mass which is minus something large, h bar, is called a mass counter term. Counter term. Because you have to add a term in the action in your functional integral to counterbalance the effect of the quantum fluctuations. Okay. So this takes into account the quantum fluctuation of the field. This quantum fluctuation modified changes the mass of the theory, and you must add a counter term to counterbalance the effect of those quantum fluctuations. Okay? So this is the basic idea which is behind renormalization theory as it was formulated in the 50s by Tyson, Schwinger, Feynman, and then formulated more mathematically, more precisely by a lot of great theoretical physicists and mathematicians. And it seems a bit strange, and renormalization for a very long time looked very mysterious, both to physicists and to mathematicians. To mathematicians because they say, oh, but you have a theory which is ill-defined, which is full and infinite, and you are changing it by adding some other infinities, and at the end you get something. This is black magic. So for the mathematicians, they didn't like it because people were starting which was from an object which was ill-defined because it contains infinities here. They were happy because you end up with a theory which is finite. For the physicists, it was the opposite. The physicists didn't like the fact that to add infinities to a theory which was defined from the very beginning. But in fact, that's not really black magic. Because you remember that what I told yesterday at the beginning of last lecture. A quantum theory is defined, in fact, by its operator and its state. Its states. So by the Hilbert space of states and by its the operator, which corresponds to the observable of the theory. And what is important is to get a theory where all the matrix elements of the observable between physical states of the theory are finite. You see, that's what is important. You get a consistent quantum theory if you have a set of observables, if you have a set of states, and they form an object which is completely consistent with finite matrix elements between the observable and the states. Okay? And the functional integral you start from is just some machine which built the matrix element of the observable of a quantum theory between different states. See? So it's a machinery that you use to build a quantum theory. And the fact that, so to build this a consistent quantum theory, you can say, okay, I take a functional integral, I introduced this cutoff lambda, so I have a functional integral, plus ultraviolet cutoff lambda. That's my machine, which built up a quantum theory. And in order to get a theory which satisfies Lorentz invariance, causality, and locality, and unitarity, what I have to do is to take the limit when lambda goes to infinity, the regulator cutoff, all the matrix element of the form out from observable in. Finite. And if I can do that, I am happy because I have a quantum theory with matrix elements of observable which are finite. You see? And that's precisely what I've been doing here for this specific matrix element. Yes?
Sir, I have a couple of questions. Suppose that I discover a physical system which I think is described by a massless scalar field.
Yes.
So, to come up with a quantum theory for that system, I should start with an action which has a mass term in it.
Yes.
And then quantize it in such a way that the end product is massless.
Yes.
The other thing is that the massless theory has this extra symmetry, scaling symmetry.
Yes.
And what happens to that in this quantization procedure?
Well, what happens to that is that the matrix elements, the states and the observable of the theory have this symmetry. So remember, I erased it, but to the symmetry is associated the current. The current in the quantum theory becomes an operator. It's one of the operators of the theory. And what's important is that this operator, this current, now considered as an observable, this current must be conserved. So the expectation value of the derivative, well, the derivative, if you have a current in a quantum theory, g mu of x, it's an operator. You see? And this current is conserved is for any matrix element of g mu of x in. Now, that's a number depending on x. So it's a vector field depending on x. And what this current will be conserved is if this is always zero, well, up to some subtleties when the in-state is defined from some operator at the same point. But up to those subtleties, what's important for a quantum theory is that you must have a current, which is an operator, which is conserved. Any time that you have a set of operators which transform as a vector under Lorentz rotations and which is conserved, it means that you have a conserved current in your theory, and therefore you must have some symmetry. You can use this current to generate transformations which are symmetries of the quantum theory. So you may have no symmetry in the functional integral. The important thing is that you have the symmetry in the quantum theory. You see? Okay. Okay. So I have spoken about mass renormalization. Okay. So now, this is for the four-point function, for the two-point function. Now you must consider also what's happening for the four-point function, the interaction between four points, for four fields. So, well, perhaps I will keep that because that's important. So let me try to write the four-point function here. Okay. So now I must consider the four points irreducible function. So this function is defined exactly in the same way. This function, which is now gamma, well, let me define it, but, gamma 4, because there are four points of z1, z4 is the functional derivative of the effective action with respect to four fields, and therefore it is given, as we have seen, by the sum over irreducible diagram with amputated legs and four points z1, z2, z3, z4. Okay? And we have seen that in the quantum theory, it is given by this diagram, which is the vertex of the theory. Okay. And then we have a plus the sum over those diagrams. So this is the diagram. These are the external points. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we have, this is an internal vertex. This is 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you have another terms, which is the same thing with, well, let us be precise. 1, 3, 2, 4. And 1, 3, 2, 4. And here are some amputated legs, and here are the real propagator. Okay? and I have a factor. And now you have to remember, in this theory, what is the coefficient from this? The coefficient from this is now C. So here you have a factor C. Here you have a factor C. Here this is a term which is of order h bar, because I have one loop. I have a factor 1/2 associated to the combinatoric factor, the symmetry factor of those diagrams. And I have two vertices, so I have a factor C squared. Now my coupling constant is C squared. And remember also that my propagator now is, my propagator is 1 over AP squared plus B. Okay, with propagator, which means, okay. So, as usual, in fact, it's better to go to the Fourier transform. So I consider the Fourier transform of this function of 4 points. So it's a function of 4 momenta. By the invariance by translation, there is a delta 4 of the sum of the 4 momenta. Okay? And then I have a function, what I will call it gamma 4, of the momenta. So let me call them those momenta simply pi. An adequate denomination here in order not to write p1, p2, p3, p4, p4 with the constraint that the sum over the 4 momenta is zero. Okay? And so that's the analog of this object. Simply, now it depends on three independent momenta. Three, because there are 4 momenta and this constraint, that the sum of all the momenta is zero. Okay? And so now, what is this function, if I calculate it? This diagram in Fourier transform gives me just C. Okay? So this is C is GR plus H bar times C1. This comes from this. Okay? And then I have another contribution. We come from the sum of these diagrams. And this is a term of order h bar. So I can replace C by GR, which is its value at leading order in h bar. So this is a GR squared. Okay. There is a factor 1/2. And then I have the contribution of these three diagrams. Okay, and these three diagrams, you know, are in fact are the same except that the position of the point is different. So in fact, you can easily see that these diagrams with a function which I will call B, which is a function of P1 plus P2, the incoming momenta, P1 plus P4, I'm sorry, it's a function of the incoming momenta here and here. And then you have the same function, which is the function of P1 plus P2, the incoming momenta here. And then you have the same function now, which is the function of the incoming momenta, P1 plus P3. Okay? And what is this function B? This function B is simply, I'm sorry if you will see it. Is it okay if I write here? No. Okay, so I will start to write it. Here, where is my... Yes. So this function B pardon? Where are there some square?
Or is the B depends on P? Or
yes, B is a function of the momenta which are the Fourier transform of the position variable z1, z2, z4. So I write it here. No, it's the expression for, oh yes, I'm sorry. This is the expression for gamma bar 4, which is a function of P1, P2, P3, where here it is understood that P4 is equal to minus P1 plus P2 plus P3. Okay? Okay, and now let me write this function B. It's a function of momenta. I can call it a Q. Okay, another momenta. And it is just, in fact, well, the amplitude associated to this diagram. So you can write it in two ways. Either you can just say that this is a Fourier transform of the products of two massless propagators. Because in momentum space, in a position space, this is just one propagator of this propagator. See, the Fourier transform of G Feynman of X squared, where G Feynman of X squared, well, of X, for the massless phi 4 theory is just, if I made no mistake, 1 over, I mean 4 dimension, so this is 1 over 4 times pi squared times 1 over modulus of x, well, x squared, where here I am in Euclidean space, okay, or I can also write this as an expression in Fourier space, and this is the integral over d4, let us write it a vector k divided by 2 pi to the power 4, 1 over k squared, that's a propagator, and that's another propagator, which is k plus q squared. And here, because it corresponds simply to write this as a diagram where you have an incoming momentum Q, an outcoming momentum Q, and here these lines carry a momentum K, and therefore these lines carry a momentum K plus Q. I think you have seen this expression of the Feynman, calculating Feynman amplitudes of Feynman diagram in Fourier space. You have seen that in the lecture by Costin Zarembo. Okay? Okay? Okay, and so this is the formal expression for this quantity. Okay? So it's a function of Q. It is given by either the Fourier transform of 1 over x4 or by this integral. That's two ways to compute the same integral. And this expression has also an ultraviolet divergence, because this integral is d4k over k squared times k plus q squared. So when k is large, you have a d4k over k4. You see? So there is a logarithmic divergence. Okay? And if you think about it in terms of Fourier transform of 1 over x squared, you have exactly the same ultraviolet divergence. This is a function. It has a singularity at x equals 0, and it has no Fourier transform. Its Fourier transform is not well defined, because it's not a compact function which is bounded, continuous. It decays at infinity, but at 0, you have a problem. Okay? Now, if you think about our regulator. We have our regulator, which means that we can compute this integral by assuming that k has to be less than 1 and k plus q has also to be less than lambda in your integral. Okay? Then you are regularizing your integral, and it's easy to see that You get a divergent term, which is of the form. Now it will be a log of lambda. Log of lambda squared. There is a divergent which is proportional to the log of lambda squared. The coefficient in front of the it turns out to be 4 pi squared. That's the result of the calculation. It's an easy calculation. Okay, so this integral is divergent. It has a regulator. So it has a logarithmic divergent, which is log of lambda. It depends on Q. And therefore, it's easy to see that, in fact, this is something of order log of lambda squared plus Q squared plus something of order 1 when lambda goes to infinity, so independent on Q, and plus terms of order Q over lambda to some power n with the sum of terms of order with n positive. Okay? And therefore, those terms are completely negligible as long as Q is much less than lambda, which is what interests us. You see? Okay? So it has a, so you see, this function, in fact, when you introduce a regulator, has an ultraviolet divergence which is proportional to a log. Then it has a finite part which behaves like a log of 1 over Q squared. And there is a log of a lambda over Q squared because those are the only two scales present in this integral, you see. In this integral depends on Q only because K is a dummy variable, so I integrate over. There is a lambda because you introduce this regulator in this integral, and, but this integral is some number which is dimensionless, so it can depend only on the ratio lambda squared over Q squared. So if you find the log of lambda squared, and you know there is a log because this integral is logarithmically divergent, you know that there is a log of Q squared without having to compute it. Okay? Okay, so remember now, this object contains a C1. It contains this two-loop contribution, and this two-loop contribution contains a divergent term which is proportional to a log. So this contains something which is 3 times 1 over 4 pi squared log of lambda squared plus something which is finite and depending on Q, on the P, on the P highs. Okay? Because here Q equal P1 plus P4, here Q equal P1 plus P2, and here Q equal P1 plus P3. You see? So now you see that you can, in order to have, if you want that gamma 4 to be finite when lambda goes to infinity, and therefore in order to have all your the 4 points, the expectation value in the vacuum of your interacting theory involving 4 field operators to be finite, you must choose C1, the coefficient which is here in the original action and which is here, so that this is finite. So you must choose C1. There was a minus sign, I'm sorry, here. There was a minus sign. That's quite important for the following. There is a minus sign here. And therefore, you must choose C1 to be of the form C1 plus, minus So there is a 3 half minus gr squared, 3 half, 1 over 4 pi squared, logarithm of lambda squared, to be finite, is finite. Okay? Exactly the same way as we had to choose a B1 to be equal to this value so that the two-point function is finite and describes a massless field theory. I have to choose a C1. So C1 has to contain a term which is singular when lambda goes to infinity in order to have a four-point function which are finite. You see? So now, let us do that. Here, let us say, exactly by the same techniques. And you see that, of course, the solution is easy. The solution is that you have to take C1 equal h-bar my coupling constant gr squared 3 half, 1 over 4 pi squared times log of lambda squared. But here I have what seems to be a technical problem, and which it will reflect a deep physical principle, is that this is a log of an energy square. And I know what is the log of 1, I know what is the log of 2, I know what is the log of pi, but I don't know what is the log of an electron volt, or I don't know what is the log of an erg, or I don't know what is the log of a meter, or I don't know what is the log of an apple, exactly like that. So I have to take the log of something which is a number. So I have to choose another mass scale, which is finite. I have to choose another mass or energy scale, mu, which for the moment is arbitrary, in order to get a four-point irreducible function finite. Okay? So, I have some liberty of choosing how I renormalize the coupling constant. Of course, this corresponds simply to a coupling constant renormalization. Okay? And what I am doing here is that I'm adding what is called a coupling constant counter term. Yes?
But we did consider log of lambda squared before.
We did?
Yeah, I mean, there.
That's the same. I see simply that I want this quantity to be finite.
So right, I but want, no, no. I mean, the
I
log
want
of lambda squared.
This to be finite.
No, you said we cannot take the log of a dimensionful quantity, right?
Yes.
But over there you've written that that is proportional to log squared.
Yeah, but there is a log square here, and here there is a log of q. I cannot consider the log of an apple or an orange, but I can consider what is the log of 2 orange minus the log of 1 orange, because it's a log of 2 orange divided by 1 orange, so it's a log of 2.
Right.
So, you see?
So do you add the mass transfer?
Yeah, pardon?
Do you have that mass transfer, the one with the p's as well?
No, it's simply, now I am choosing, there is a C1 here. Can you see? I choose C1 to be this.
The other, the C1, does should it have h-bar in it?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, with this definition, C1 wait for yes, of course. C1, yeah. Okay. So this is one choice which makes my correlation function finite. And finally, if I am doing that, and we shall end here for today, I think, I get as a final result a four-point function which is finite, which is equal to gr plus h bar times, and now I have minus gr squared 1/2, factor 1/2, and then I have a function which is this quantity which is divergent minus this quantity, so I get something which is 1 over 4 pi squared logarithm of mu squared divided by P1 plus P4 squared, okay, plus same thing for P1 plus P2, plus the same thing for P1 plus P3, okay. Which is finite. This is finite. So I define a two-point function for my theory, which is ultraviolet finite in the limit. Lambda goes to infinity. Okay. It depends on P1 plus P4. It's an expansion in terms of this quantity gr that I call the generalized constant, but it depends, it seems to depend on a new constant, mu. You see? So I get rid of the ultraviolet divergences, but there is an important difference between what I did for the mass and what I did for the Hartree constant. It seems that I have introduced a new arbitrariness in my definition of the theory by introducing this new mass energy scale, which is called, in fact, mu is called the renormalization energy or mass scale. Okay? And so there is a very important difference between the renormalization of the mass and the renormalization of the energy. We have seen that if we want a theory which is massless, this fixes completely the counter term we have for the mass. But if we want to have the four-point function to be finite, you have to renormalize the Copley constant. I can do it. But this renormalization depends on a parameter which I had to introduce, which is as a dimension of energy, which is called the renormalization mass scale. Yes?
I just make the point of kind of the physical interpretation of this energy scale. So, can I make the point about the physical interpretation of this energy scale?
So I'm going to talk to discuss that tomorrow because I have no time to spend that. I can just, okay, I can say what? Well, I can say the significance of this renormalization scale is that in fact, I have not defined exactly, I have this parameter gr, which is a Copley constant, which is finite. But I have not said at all how I measure this complete constant. It's just some parameter in my expression. And in fact, I will show tomorrow that if you think a little bit about how you define a coupling constant, the strength of an interaction in a quantum physics theory, it must depend on the energy at which you make the measurement of this interaction. See? And therefore, in fact, this energy scale corresponds to the energy at which the coupling of the theory is measured so that it is equal to the parameter GR here. Yes. But I think I prefer to. Well, it takes. It's not very long, but you have to just. I prefer to do that tomorrow, because get an idea that this is not another mathematical fancy of quantum field theory. It corresponds to some physical important point that, in order to define what is a coupling constant in a quantum field theory, you have to make measurements of interaction between particles, and especially for massless particles where you have no energy scale, you have to specify whether you make, for instance, a scattering of particles which have an energy of 1 eV, or 1 kilo eV, or 1 MeV, or 1 GeV, or 1 TeV, and the number you get from such experiments, from such scattering experiments, are different. Okay. Yes?
The other functions. We'll pick up like the 8-point differences. Yes. Will I get a constant for each one?
In fact, not, and that's what I want to mention later. But remember, we already, if I consider now, so you see, this is the diagram for the 2-point function. It contains a log. These are the diagram for the 4-point function. They contain a log of lambda. Now, if you go on and consider what are the diagrams at one loop, which are present in the 6-point function, in fact, you do just a little bit of power counting, and you discover that when you integrate over the internal momenta, then you have an integral of d4k over k6. Okay, and this is perfectly well defined at infinity, no convergence. The fact that there are no, this is over the 1. You have a term which depends on lambda, but it's of order 1 over lambda squared. So it disappears. So this is over, so this is finite. This is finite for the 8-point function, this is finite, etc. So at one loop, you only need, in fact, the renormalization of the mass, the renormalization of the coupling constant. You might have needed also a renormalization of the du phi squared terms. But it turns out for the 5-4 theory, it's not needed. For other theories like quantum electrodynamics, it's needed, but it goes along the same line of reasoning. There is also a log associated to that, and that's basically because, in fact, when you are considering a generic 2-point function, for instance, in quantum this is the diagram for 5-4 theory, you see, and this is the same one loop diagram for QED. You see? For 5-4, you have just a lambda squared. For QED, you have the power counting is a bit different because the dimension of the propagator of the fermion is 1 over 2. Remember? The propagator for the fermion is 1 over P slash, and not 1 over P squared. So here, in fact, you have a lambda, you see? But in fact, you have also a log lambda. But this log lambda turns out to be proportional to P squared for massless electrons. And therefore, this log of lambda for QED can be absorbed into a renormalization of the kinetic term. Well, here it will be a psi bar, d slash psi, and not... But, oh, and the miracle is that when you go, yeah, okay, so now the very important fact here is that, in fact, there is a theorem called the PPHD theorem by the name of the Russian and I think German and Swiss physicists. This is Bogolyubov. This is Tarachuk, two Russian physicists.
this is Hepp, this is Zimmermann. We find the name spelled in the in Peskin books, which states that basically, I am oversimplifying the theorem, but it means that this works all over in perturbation theory. Okay? And of course, you have to work much harder to show why it works, but basically the idea behind the fact theorem is that all the ultraviolet divergence are always contained in products of operators. And so if you want to look at the divergence at higher order, in fact, you may very well have operator which are something like 5-4, 5-4, 5-4, 5-4, and you compute expectation value of 5-4, and you may have 5-4 everywhere, like that, and you have a divergence function where if 2 5-4 come close together, but then you may have a divergence of you when those come close together at a fast rate, then those come close together but at a lower rate, etc. So in fact, the structure of divergence at higher order is something very, very complicated, you know, because you have sub-divergences within divergences within divergences within divergences. And this is studied, this is understood since the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 70s. The theorem goes back, I think, to 79 or 60, but these are different versions. Mathematicians are still working on this subject, and for instance, the structure recently, well, during the last 10 years, mathematicians came out with the fact that you can analyze those divergences using a quite sophisticated mathematical object called an Hopf algebra. So you see, there are some interesting objects. But basically, all this is contained in the fact that there is an OPE structure for all those behaviors. You can, even if you have subset of point collapsing within set of collapsing point, you can always describe that in terms of a more complicated operator product expansion within an operator product expansion within an operator product expansion. The operator product expansion involves local operator, and therefore, if the counting of the divergence is okay, everything works. Yes?
How is the 6-point function finite if you've got d4k over k to the 6 integrating over space?
It's finite. The integral is finite when k is large.
But for k small.
But when k is small, of course, then in fact it's not exactly k squared. You have a k plus some momentum q1 squared, then you have a k plus some momentum q2 squared, etc., where here this is the momentum q1, here this is the momentum q2, and as long as those momenta, some of them are not equal or the sum, that's fine. If, for instance, all those momenta are equal to zero, then you run again into problem, it's a problem related to the large distance behavior of the theory. So you have singularities when Q, so as long as the Q1, Q2, etc. are different from zero, it's okay. If some of the Qs are equal to zero, you run into problem, but those are called infrared singularities. And they are connected to a completely different aspects of the physics of massless field. In fact, for instance, it means that you cannot consider a massless particle alone when it's, if it interacts with other particles, it's always dressed. You know, an electron, you know, an electron is dressed by quantum fluctuations, pairs of electrons, anti-electrons. But if the electron has a mass, you know, you cannot create easily pairs of electrons and positrons by quantum fluctuations. Because it costs energy. If the particle is massless, it costs no energy. So any particle, in fact, in an interacting theory, is dressed by, if it is dressed by a cloud of massless particles,
you need to work much more to define really what is a state of an asymptotic state of a particle moving in the vacuum. These problems are quite technical, yes, but they don't occur at one loop, so I didn't mention them. Okay, so yeah, but we should we can discuss that in
It depends on the square.
Yes.